Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Mr. Sullivan.
There I am.
There he is. Welcome to Cloudlandia.
Yes, indeed.
From the Northern Ontario outpost.
Yeah. And we're having just the opposite weather from what they're having out west.
Oh, my goodness. How has it been? You're 2 weeks.
Well, for the last 3 days, it's been very cold and rainy.
Oh, that's no good.
Oh, well.
Well, that's good. Well, I've missed you. That was 2 weeks now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're having a great week, tremendous exercise week. And I have a CPAP. You know, I use a CPAP at night.
You use it every night, I guess, right? You have to. Yeah.
So I got it in 2011, in February of 2011, and I've missed 5 nights.
Wow. So you're able to, nothing, I've often wondered about that how do you enjoy that? I mean, the outcome of it or whatever, what was the...
You know, I mean, Babs was the one that alerted me to the fact that I snored at night, and...
Uh-huh.
And she would jab me. But what she was worried about is that, you know, what happens is that there's this little flap at the top of your air pipe.
Uh-huh.
And it closes. And
yes.
So your heart speeds up because it's trying to get rid of the carbon dioxide. So it's very, very interesting. We don't breathe so much to get oxygen. We breathe to get rid of carbon dioxide.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I went to Canyon Ranch where we go a lot. And the doctor there is a sleep doctor that we have. His specialty is sleep disorder.
Nice.
So I just signed up, and what they do is you just pack up for the night, and they have a bedroom in the medical center that's, you know, just like one of their, like one of the guest rooms, but you go in and then they wire you
with
electrodes all over your chest and, you know, you're wired up, and then you sleep half the night as you would anyway, you go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of the night, they wake you up and they put the CPAP on. And it's a thing that fits over your nose. In my case, it keeps my jaw shut, and then it covers my nose. And
okay.
When you turn it on, it just blows air through a tube. And the blowing of the air kind of forces you to breathe. So the machine does your breathing for you, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, they're taking a record, and they video you, and they also have an audio recording during the night. And then, you know, you get up in the morning and you go about your business. And then later in the afternoon, they have the stats back, you know, statistics of what happened. And it was really quite striking because it was a visual, you know, where there's a pen moving and it shows the ups and downs. And it was like stormy seas for the first hour. You could see these big eruptions, you know, these big spikes.
Yeah.
And the last 4 hours, it was as calm as can be. It was just more or less a straight line.
Wow.
So I said, well, you had me on hello. Let's do it. And first of all, I found the actual being on the machine actually enjoyable. One is because you don't have to do any work. I mean, you don't have to do the work. The machine is doing the work. And ever since then, you know, I just did it. One night, 1 week, we went to Chicago, and I forgot a piece of it. And so I didn't do it. And,
so you had a whole week without it.
I had five days, and it's the only 5 days that missed. I always... When I'm packing to go on a trip, I make sure the first thing is
Wow. And no, what was your experience on the 5 days?
Yeah, well, it was hard. I had to sleep on, I had to sleep in a different position, and
okay.
I still woke up and I snored, and the whole thing. So it's one of those things where technology really helps.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's
yeah, and I've talked to other people about it. And Babs has got one now too, because once I stopped snoring, we discovered that she snored.
Oh, that's so funny.
I said, it's sort of scientific. Eliminate the possibilities. Well, I was the first possibility, and we eliminated Deanna's possibility, so there was only one thing left. But she didn't realize it because I was waking her up so much. She didn't realize, we never zeroed in on her. But I'll tell you how different it is. So let's just take the first 4 hours of the night when I was as normal. I was woken up 18 times in a 2 hour period. So they use the 2 hour period as their standard of measurement. Mm-hmm. And that means that about every, that's about every 6 minutes.
Yes.
I was being kind of unsettled by the fact that my heart started racing and it was trying to get rid of the carbon dioxide. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's considered 18 times. So it's 9 times an hour, 18 times during 2 hours is considered mild apnea.
Right. Yeah.
In other words, I interrupted myself 18 times in 2 hours. Uh-huh. And that's considered mild. And I said, if that's mild, what's severe? He says, oh, you get it with pro football players. And one of the big things is how big your neck is.
Right.
If you have a really big neck, then it has an adverse effect. And mm-hmm. he says, some truck drivers, really. And they said, they'll wake themselves up every minute and a half.
Wow. Every 90 seconds, you're like.
Every 90 seconds, yeah. So with the apnea, it's down to one time during a 2 hour period, which is considered no apnea. Yeah. So
that's amazing.
So anyway, but one of the things is I sleep better. I just get better rest, like I'm really calm, and sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'm just sitting there and I'm so relaxed because I'm not doing any work. And the machine is just doing the work. And then it gives you a record. It keeps a record. It's got a little chip in it, and it keeps a record. Yeah,
do you use an Oura ring as well?
No, I did, but it didn't really. The machine has a record, and you can go through.
Gotcha.
For example, I just checked it this morning, and over the last 7 days, I've gotten an average of 9 hours sleep.
Wow, that's great, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm swimming. I'm swimming every day, and I'm doing.
Yeah,
I have a real cardio circuit here because we have hills.
Yeah,
here and
right hills.
And so I really get about an hour of really good cardio every day. So I'm tired. I'm getting lots of sunlight, and it's been great. I mean, we've just had a delightful. It's going to be about 9 days by the time we get back. And
yeah.
It's just been, and I don't mind it. I mean, if you hadn't come to grips with weather by the time you're 77 years old, you're just, there's no hope for you.
Right. Exactly. That's so great.
Yeah.
Well, I thought about you, it's an interesting August 1st today, by the way. Happy August.
Yep. Holiday here.
Yeah. That's right. Monday will be a holiday, right? Right.
Mm-hmm.
You said something a couple of conversations ago. We were talking about you were coming up on, that was in July, right? Was the first.
Yeah. So it was last Monday.
Last Monday.
It was 3 years. Yeah.
And so you look at that. You just, said something
just to
that
explain
was
to the audience what the 3 years mm-hmm. I hadn't watched television for 3 years, so I made it through 3 years without watching. When I say television, I do watch some videos on the internet,
right?
You know, like mm-hmm. Things, but just actually turning on the television, and we've got one of those weird systems where you have to do about five things to get the television on. And to
right.
save my life today, I can't remember how to turn the television on.
You don't know the rain dance you need to do to get it work. Yeah, exactly. But what you said that was really been kind of rolling around in my mind is that there's, I'm paraphrasing from memory, but that there's nothing going on the television or out in that world that's more interesting than what's going on inside your brain, inside your own thoughts, your own. And I thought, man, that is that's an interesting distinction that nobody's making, you know? I've been observing
it's really interesting if you look at the progress of television, say. Mm-hmm. I think probably it became really mainstream in the early 1950s when you had the three networks. And mm-hmm. I read, you know, that Tim Wu, who's really a great historian of what he calls information companies. So that would be anything, you know, it would be radio, it would be TV, internet, and all things like that, movies. And what he says is that by the 1970s, and this was one of the major players in the television industry, one of the heads of the networks. And he says, you know, we've kind of got them now, because when they sit in front of the television, real life is what's happening on the other side of the screen. Their lives are not real. And he says, and now we've got them. He says, we've got them. Once we can convince them that real life is what they're watching on the screen, not what they're actually living when the television is. And I always remembered that. And I said, well, we'll see about that. But for a lot of people, it really is. And then, of course, social media really, you know, took that to the nth degree. That if they're not looking at their phone, you know, and, you know, actually interacting with happening. So it's kind of like what's really happening is somewhere else. It's not where they actually are.
And like Plato's caves.
It's very much. Yeah. I mean, there's some fundamental philosophical and issues is what's reality for you? Is reality something that someone else is creating? Is it someone else that you're just a passive observer of? Is that what reality is? So, I think one of the enjoyable things about our relationship is that we do an enormous amount of thinking when we're alone. Yeah. And that thinking is really more important. I mean, other people's thinking is useful or non-useful. In other words, we tune in on what other people are thinking, but it doesn't it's not the trump card. The trump card is what you're, you know, the decisions you're making.
This is where I kind of wonder aloud about this, you know, like, so I notice that, yes, there's a lot of, whenever I turn my attention inward, and with my notebook, I spend a lot of time thinking and journaling and you know, thinking of making sense of what I'm seeing. But a lot of the stuff that I think about is informed by what I'm observing. And for instance, it's such a less outside input, but I look at what some of the biggest breakthroughs that I've had are things that come from observing what's actually happening right now out there. And so I look at, like, there's not many, you know, it's something we look at it, like we sit in our strategic coach, in our workshops or in our things, and there's not many 55-year-old men that are hip to what's going on with Kylie Jenner and Lil Nas X. And, you know, when, like I say that, a lot of them have never heard, maybe they've heard of Kylie Jenner, but they've never heard of Lil Nas X, or to be able to understand the backstory of what's going on, or Mr. Beast Burger, that all of those things are, because I spend a lot of time watching what's going on, and balancing it, putting it through the processing plant that I've got of observing it, you know, not just, I guess that's a difference of, I'm not just taking it in as entertainment or whatever, you know, I'm watching with a purpose. But
yeah. Well, I think you've, you know, if I can observe the observer here.
Right.
That going back, because we've had pretty well continuous conversations on a whole series of topics for the past decade.
Okay. Yes.
That what you have is a particular, what I would say, framework about how the world is developing. Okay. And part of your decision, and I think all people have this, by the way, I think it's that every human being has a particular take on the world. Okay.
Yes.
And what they look for is evidence from the outside to support their take.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a take that we've crossed over into an entirely new way of operating in the world, and
it's
and there's a border between, you know, the physical world, and there's this new digital world that's been created. And you've had that for a long time, because you've actually turned this into different kinds of digital products, including your mapping out of neighborhoods.
Yes.
Then went on the internet, and it was purchasable. You could actually purchase the 8-part, I think it's an 8-step process for a real estate.
That's right.
To make sense, where they could actually probably have the same customers over a 40-year period if they wanted to, because those customers would be moving from one type of home to another type of home based on what was happening in their life. And in any words, it didn't matter if one person went through all 8. Wherever someone was, there was probably another step that they could make. That's what
right.
I got out of that. You know. Or a step down. They could do a step down. They might downsize. They could either upsize or downsize. And also move to a nicer code. To a nicer part of the. So it seems to me that you have a permanent model that you're working on, and every quarter, every year, it's a better model because you have more evidence and more support, and you've thought of new ways of thinking about this. My take is that everybody has this. Everybody has this. And that humans don't have general knowledge. They have very, very specific knowledge. Okay. And it's a bet we're making on the future. You know, I have a exercise in the next quarter for the 10 times group, and it's called Good at Guessing.
Oh, yeah.
Are you good at guessing?
I like that.
And then we take a look at, first of all, because not everybody is.
Right.
You know, we're all guessers. In other words, that Elon Musk is a guesser. You know, everybody's a guesser. And the reason is because the future is unpredictable. And some people are better at feeling out the way things are going than they aren't. And I would say it's because they're more conscious of the model that they've created. I think I think Elon Musk has probably an extraordinarily well-developed model about how things are going to go. And it puts him ahead of the vast majority of other people. And, you know, you don't have to be... You don't have to be 100 miles ahead. You have to be at least a block ahead.
Place your bet and see how it goes. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's relative. You have a relative.
It's like a wave. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you're sitting there and you're watching this wave. And if you start paddling, you might be on the top of that wave. At the time you're leaving. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at every person, they have some sort of specialized knowledge that they've really focused on and developed over the course of their life. The only difference is that worth it's worth something to you because you stay with it. The only question is it worth anything to anybody else?
Yeah,
because we're always looking for the person who has shortcuts.
Right. I'm thinking about like my thinking. I've been consciously allocating more time to making the distinction of, is this time here, what I'm doing now, is this, you know, opening my eyes to something new that's going to go, or is it sharpening something? But I was thinking about some in I was thinking about capabilities, and I saw something that was pretty neat. When I went to the virtual dining concepts website, they do a really good job of explaining what their concept is. They're essentially saying, we know you've got, you know, it's essentially you've got this equipment. You've got the capability to do more than what you're doing. That's what the excess capacity is. But when they look at it, what they do, when you strip away the vision of what your particular restaurant is, right, you're left with the core things, which is the equipment. When you look at it, every kitchen that in every restaurant has some combination of an oven, a pizza oven if they have that capability, a freezer, the ability to freeze stuff, fryer, a flat top griddle type of thing, and refrigeration. So those are the baseline elements that if you've got those capabilities, you can add any of their virtual dining concepts to prepare their menu, add their vision, which is what recipes, concepts, all of those things are, you know, preparations, branding, all that stuff. You combine their vision with your capabilities, and now you've got an outcome, an ability. And the thing that was the thought that I had was the difference between a capability and an ability. Is the capability is the potential to do something, right? But an ability is
it's actually that using
realized,
it.
Is using yeah. it. That's exactly
that's right. a great distinction. So that's a great yes. distinction. Yeah.
So a lot of people have the capability to do Mr. Beast Burgers or to do Tiger Bites or Guy Fieri. A lot of people have the capability, but they don't have the ability. They don't have the vision to do it. So when you combine vision with a capability, now you've got an ability to do something. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's really... So I kind of started looking at that like in other situations, like that's true.
Well, you know, I mean, and we acquire, you know, I think the ability improves by actually transforming capabilities into results. In other words, your ability to do something.
And the number of times that you've done that is a skill. Skill is what comes from this. I was thinking about music, for instance. If we take the ability to, you know, create a hit song, the capabilities are, you know, a guitar and keyboard and a bass and drums or any, all the other instruments. But let's just take those big four.
Yeah.
Anybody that has all of those things has the capability to produce something, but in the hands of McCartney and Lennon, those things, you know, in the Beatles, that became, they've done it better than anybody ever.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's not even the musicianship of it. There are technically better musicians, you know, it's you could argue same thing with the Rolling Stones, same thing with any of the big bands. It's not necessarily, you know, that they're masterful things. It's all on the back of this, the reach that they've developed, which
the other thing that happens, it happens forwards, where you have a capability and then you take the capability and produce a result. But it also happens backwards, in the sense that you notice a new ability appears. That's just on the, you know, it's just on a, it's a single person's ability, because I think abilities are human. You know, they're actually what the human being can do. And then you have, let's take Lennon and McCartney. Together, they were dynamite. I mean, they were. There was something about them, you know, writing the music and, you know, putting the orchestration together and planning it, that was extraordinary. And then it got copied, and all of a sudden, the Beatles changed the entire music world. Now you had 50 would-be Beatles outfits out there, and some of them were quite good. I mean, some of them were quite good. But that's what happens when unique abilities take advantage of a capability and they create something new in the marketplace, then everybody else tries to imitate. Everybody else tries to copy. Okay. And the one really interesting example of that, it was the Jersey Boys, the musical, the Jersey Boys. So this is Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Yeah. And it was very, very interesting. So I've actually seen it twice. I saw it in Toronto, and I saw it in New York. Different guests. So we took different guests.
Yeah.
And it was kind of funny growing up. I mean, I wasn't a real someone who was up on the what the music was being played, but I do remember Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. So I sat through the musical twice, and then I got home and I went on the internet and I played the original. These were old video recordings of Frankie Valli, not the actors on stage, but Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. And there were some interviews with Frankie Valli. The musicianship in the play, and the voices of the actors who were portraying Frankie Valli were infinitely higher quality than Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons.
Right. Yeah.
And Frankie Valli said, you know, first of all, the beat was much sharper. It was a much crisper beat. And the reason was they had dancing and everything like that. You know. And Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons were a bunch of New Jersey guys who got gigs at local clubs, you know, and then started making records and everything like that. But they were kind of drowsy. It looked like the beat was slower. And they, you know, he was clearly the superior talent. I mean, Frankie Valli just had a marvelous, voice and everything like that. But all the singers, you know, in the Broadway, and it was a Broadway play and musical, they were much, much superior. than they were. And Frankie Valli says, oh, he says, we could never sing that good. He says, I enjoy going to see it. He says, because he says, I sit there and I say, why, boy, what we could have been, because, but yet the original has a quality to it that the play doesn't, because right. the actors are pretending to be something where the originals yeah. were just being themselves.
Yeah. Isn't that something? And that's kind of like that's where there's lots of, you know, you're right. There's lots of Beatles cover bands that technically play the songs and play it well, but there's none. There's no cover bands in the Hall of Fame, right?
No.
No. No cover bands in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah. But the process that you're talking about just shows, you know, and we've seen this and we've known it in, you know, all sorts of activities like, you know, theater and movies and that. We know that there's this pushing out, the capability grows, and then every once in a while you have an ability that takes the capability to a new standard. Okay.
And then everybody
tries to capture this new thing and build it back into a predictable capability.
And then even that then is, you know, the reach of it is the most critical thing. That's to make the difference. There's so many situations where people with, you know, amazing skill and abilities don't get, that's not enough.
Yeah. And I think part of it is,
it's like the thing that's not the multiplier. That's not the multiplier.
No. Yeah.
The multiplier is the reach.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much you're able to get that out into the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was looking big
Yeah, it's like streaming, you know, what streaming has done to the music world. And what I understand is that Drake, the singer from Toronto, is the number one streaming artist in the world.
Yeah.
And he got on it right away. I mean, he understood what the potential was right away, and he started doing it. So he's just got a huge, I mean, it's in the hundreds of millions of people who just automatically, if it's Drake, they download. Yeah. They download.
See, that's a perfect segue. Because now that I started thinking about, this is what I've been doing with thinking about my thinking here, Dan. Instead of watching another Shark Tank episode, I've been turning my thoughts inward.
Yeah.
And this is the outcome here.
Well, you know, I mean, the whole point is to understand what Dean Jackson is working on, because you're working on a capability that's unique in the world that nobody, the only question is, do you recognize it as such?
Yes, that's it. And this is where the reach of it, this is where I've been thinking now about the role of reach in something is whether, you know, it's somebody in the past has discovered, somebody with reach has discovered the Beatles or discovered somebody or recognized that capability or ability and nurtured it and whatever, put it into the world. And I think about, you know, the level, this is where I was thinking about that reach. I've been trying to define what is reach, and really reach is, it's not just numbers, it's access to attention, right? Is really what reach is. And there are different levels of attention that we have, like the tippy top level of attention that you can have is your own raving fans. Like Drake, 200 million, hundreds of millions of people that whatever Drake puts out they're immediately going to download and stream that. Mm-hmm. And that's how Beyonce, every now and then, they don't even, you know, last few times she'd done this, I was secretly been creating a whole album and then just launches her album, just said, oh, I got a new album. And it immediately breaks the internet because she's got hundreds of millions of fans who just go and are going to consume whatever she says, whatever comes out of her mouth, right? And that's the pinnacle reach asset that we should, that we've got. That's the target. That's what we're moving towards, is having our own peak reach asset of people who will consume whatever we come out with, you know? Yeah. Then there's a couple of layers on that, that the next layer down from that, who are people who are, they're not your biggest fans, your raving fans, but they know you, they like you, they trust you, and they'll consider whatever you're saying if it matches with what they're looking for. And then you're going down to the level of people who know you and like you enough to identify themselves. These would be people who get on your email list, for instance. Mm-hmm. Right? They're not a raving fan yet, but they're somebody, they know you and they like you enough that they're saying, okay, I'm willing to investigate here, or I'm willing to, I think you, there may be something here. So those are the levels of things. But the other, we're largely all of these, then we draw a line that there's now the people who don't know you yet. Mm-hmm. And the highest level of access that you can have to people who don't know you is access, reach access to other people's biggest fans on their recommendation. Like your, this is where influence comes in, right? That your influence, Dan, is such that if you tell somebody in person who's one of your biggest fans, this is what a referral is, right? Is if you tell someone that they need to do this, they need to, if they need marketing, they need to talk to me, or they need to, you know, whatever we, you know, whoever you're recommending, that's the highest level of access to an unknown audience. Mm-hmm. Like when you say, if you want to get in touch with the future, then you need to be in Peter Diamandis's orbit.
Yeah. Right.
Because he's got it all there. And the same thing, and same, your collaboration with Gino, with the EOS community. Yes. Right. That, those are the peak level of recommendations, access to. Now you can give somebody platform access where I think about Dr. Phil and Dr. Oz, for instance. They started out as, you know, Dr. Oz and Dr. Phil for 4 or 5 years were heavy contributors to the Oprah world, right? They were part of the Oprah show.
I think they just started off as guests, you know.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and then she'd have them back as regular guests, you know, like,
yes. And then they'd be featured. Yeah.
And then gradually they got their own startup. They got their own platform. And then she pushed it. She pushed it.
Right.
And well, the you know, the biggest, you know, the biggest thing is that there's kind of a I get a feeling at any given time, you know, in the world right now, which is largely, you know, a media world, one way or another media, you know, it could be radio, it could be television, it could be, you know, it could be, you know, it could be the internet, it could be the social media. So you've got this, you obviously have this whole new force in the world that's basically been created over the last 100 years. And then the thing is that there's a center of attention at any given time. You know, for, and we've got a good example over the last 16 months, the center of attention has been a pandemic. And then, and then there's 20 different issues, you know, that are off pandemic. And so it's kind of like, you know, it's like a media hurricane, you know, it's circling and it's, and, and there's a center of it. And people want to know what's the best way for me in my daily life to kind of think about this and, you know, take action on this and be on the safe side of it, you know, and who do we believe that's telling us the news? And I would say that there's been probably a 50% loss of credibility in the last year of political authorities charged politically. And I believe there's been a 50% drop off in the believability of medical and scientific people on this issue, because there's been too much conflicting and there's been too much going back and forth that people can't get a steady fix on anything.
Okay. Well, part of that, so people is that say, you've got exposure to dissenting opinions in what appears to be as authoritative a voice as what used to be in the past, right? You can look official.
Yeah. And the other thing is that politicians, by definition, are partisan. You know, I mean, it's one party or the other party, you know.
Yes.
And now we're discovering probably that medical authorities are partisan, that they're not objective, that they're not objective. And I think probably the biggest discovery, and it's probably one of the greatest discoveries of my lifetime, is that scientists are not objective. They play favorites, you know, that, and it has to do with their funding. Where does their funding come from? You know, and so people are starting to understand that the objectivity of science, you know, is not a person, that the actual scientists are not objective. But there may be certain things that we just know, you know. I mean, and that's why science took on such a, you know, such a high authority, that there's just some things related to science, like turning on an electric switch, which is so predictable and dependable, you say, well, it's like electricity, you know, if you put the switch on this way, you get the electricity. But the individuals themselves are not, you know, I think they're lacking in authority because they're just ordinary people, you know, they got a job and they don't represent science. A scientist is not science. A scientist is someone who studied science and has passed certain exams and has gotten a degree and everything else. But most of his life, he's not being a scientist. Most of his life, he's just being an ordinary individual. And then certain hours of the day and so many days per week, he's doing work, which technically qualifies as science. So I think that, but your point about the fact that there's now general awareness of what scientists are and scientists are not, politicians are, politicians are not, which is, there's more knowledge, there's more, what I would say, more people can make judgments about what these people do than in the 1950s, for example.
Yeah. Well, there's more, and this is what it's confusing now, that there's more, we're bombarded with so many competing voices too, right?
Yeah.
Like it wasn't, I mean, in the old days when, if Walter Cronkite told you something, then that's it. Or if the president said something, that's
Well, you know, there's
that's
that
it, right?
famous there was this famous battle in the Vietnam War. It happened in early 1968. Lyndon Johnson was president, and he had been overwhelmingly voted in because he was the vice president when John Kennedy was assassinated, and he came in, and it was a blowout election. But then things started happening during his 4 years. You had all sorts of negative things happening, including economic, and there was, it was called the Tet Offensive, and it was an attempt by the Viet Cong to take over the south of Vietnam, and it was badly defeated. The American troops, especially the Marines, just devastated the Viet Cong. It was the end of the Viet Cong. The Viet Cong did not exist as a important battle group. It now became the North Vietnamese Army. But Walter Cronkite and all the media made a decision that the Americans had lost that battle. And he came on and said, no, this is another setback for America. And Lyndon Johnson, the evening, was watching Walter Cronkite. And he says, if Walter Cronkite thinks it's lost, then I'm dead as a politician. Wow. And about a month after that, he said he wasn't going to run for president. And it came directly from Walter Cronkite saying to the American people, this is not a good war. This war is lost.
Isn't that amazing? That there's
but the
no...
facts, when they've done the historical, the examination, is that the communist Vietnamese had better PR in the American news media than the president of the United States had.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that and so we begin to understand that it's the perceptions of things, not the reality of things, that makes a difference. Mm-hmm.
And now anybody can be Walter Cronkite. That's the thing, right? That's the voice.
Well, it's like Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan gets 100 million every day, and there's this minor rebellion at Spotify, paid 100 million,
Spotify, yes.
Yeah, Spotify. And there's this minor rebellion among the staff that he's saying things that are incorrect. They're politically incorrect. He's got all sorts of opinions that we don't agree with. And so you've got, even inside your companies now, if you look at why the Coca-Cola and Nike and all these companies are coming out in favor of what I think are politically partisan positions. And the reason is that there's a 15% of their workforce who's going to leak things, is going to make them the news. They're going to object and everything else.
Yeah.
And CEOs don't become successful CEOs if that's going on inside their company, because it drops the share price on Wall Street, goes down. If investors don't want any friction in their they don't want to see any friction, but it's a minority, and probably these people were protesters when they were in university. They cowed their professors, they cowed the administration in the universities, and now they're cowing the CEOs and management of their company. And that's all possible because of digital communications.
Yeah, the ability. You wonder, like, if you all those things pointing in the same direction, kind of thing. The root end of it is probably in the transparency family, I guess. Right? There's no room for darkness and shielding things.
Yeah. Even the perception that things are being covered up is a fact.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fact. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, I've read a lot about the history of the impact of, you know, publishing, which had a huge impact on literacy. You know, before the printing press, hardly anybody was literate. Very, very small percentage. And uh-huh. then within about 200 years after, you had a very significant growing population of people who were literate. So, and they had access to their own documents. They had access to their own authors. And, you know, I mean, in a very small version, because, but you were alone with your thoughts. In other words, that the thing that people fear most, if you're totalitarian or you're a dictator, is that people are alone with their thoughts and they're making decisions that you don't know uh-huh. about. Yeah, and I think this is why the Chinese have tried to establish a uniform, you know, kind of surveillance society. They want to be able to see is this person even looking at us wrong, you know?
Watch right.
his eyes. What kind of thoughts is he thinking if his yeah. eyes are doing that, you know, and everything else? And that just shows because they have so much to cover up.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been a total secrecy society forever for yeah. 4,000 years, for 4,000 years, you know. It's,
yeah. Well, now you look at people say, walking around with our goggles that show there's Dan Sullivan and here's his social score and his credit score and his net worth and his everything is accessible. There's no hiding. Really yeah. interesting.
That, or you could just show up on time, do what you say you're going to do, finish what you say.
Right. So that
thank
people,
you.
Yeah, that they come to that own conclusion because
yeah,
that's
yeah.
what
I mean,
leads to.
Yeah. That's, you know, have I ever told you that little routine of two furniture stores on the same street?
Which one was the best one on the block?
Yeah. 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 And then they opted.
But say it again, because I think it's so
yeah,
true.
Well, it kind of shows you what happens. So one of them puts up a sign, the best furniture store on the street, so they were on the same street. And then the other one says, best furniture store on the block. The other one said, best furniture store in the district, and then the city, and then the suburb, then the town, uh-huh. the city, and then the county, then the state, then the country, and then the planet, and then the solar system.
Yes.
And then once one of them got to the solar system, the other one said, best store on the street.
Exactly. We're local. Yes.
We're local. Yeah. We're real.
Yeah.
We're out in the solar system somewhere. We're real. And I think that happens. There's this one-upping that goes on, and you get yeah. further and further removed from what the check writer or the customer is actually looking for.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah, I think there's something, I mean, that was I want to get a couple of these on the record here for our, to pick up again for our next conversation.
Okay.
Because yep. there was a couple of more levels of this reach, right? Like, so your own reach has different levels of it, flavors
mm-hmm.
from the people. It starts with them knowing you all the way up to them being your raving fan who will do anything you say. Then there's other people access to their layers of that same relationship that they have with people. Because everybody's got reach that is layered like that. Like there are certain people mm-hmm. that if you just say to them, you need to go to this person, it's a done deal. They're done.
Yeah.
And that's what we all want anyway. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that would be the best thing is that we know who the right who is for something. If we have a who, that's the best thing. But if we don't have a who, I would hope that if you have a who, you can turn me on to your who of it, right?
Well, that's a shortcut. You know, the book that I'm sending out to everybody for the September, October, November, the next quarter coming out. So I bought a book and it's called The Secret of Our Success. And and I think I've told it. The author's name is Joe Heinrich, and just a fascinating guy. But the thesis of the book is that humans are the only continually learning shortcut species on the planet. Why have humans dominated all the other species on the planet? You know, and the really big ones we've mostly killed off. You know, I mean, the ones that are really big and dangerous, they didn't last very long. We killed them off. And how did humans do that? We're not really strong as creatures. We're not particularly fast. We can't climb trees very well and everything like that. How do we do this? And what it was is that we just combined our shortcuts to create shortcut breakthroughs. You know,
like
going from hunting to agriculture, from agriculture, learning that you don't kill off other people if you can make them into customers.
Yes.
great breakthrough, actually, you know, and everything like that. But is the other person have a thought? Do they have a way of taking action, a way of describing things that saves me time and energy?
Right. That's exactly.
I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm, one thing I'm going to put in a request right now. Can you get a top-notch expert on ghost chickens? Ghost kitchens for our summit next February. Could you get somebody here?
Well, I think I could. I was going to reach out to have Robert Earl on the Isle of Marketing Zoom, and I was thinking about him for the Genius Network annual event. But it might be a good thing for the summit as well.
Well, I mean, you could do them all because the vast majority of the Free Zone people don't go to Genius.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think
it wouldn't matter. I mean.
Because he's got a history of being that visionary that when I look at this access to reach, he clued in early on when he founded Planet Hollywood that access to people's love for Bruce Willis and Sylvester Stallone would translate into, oh, they've got a restaurant. We got to go try their restaurant.
Yep.
That's
maybe he'll be there. Maybe he'll be there.
Yeah. Maybe he'll be there.
Yeah. You're in the Planet Hollywood restaurant in Kiev, the Ukraine. And hey, maybe Bruce Willis will be there tonight. That shows you the power of that, though.
Yeah. So I'm going to keep exploring this because what I found about if you don't, barring you having them, and exhausting the opportunities of other people who have them the blessing is we can do it with outside reach because now we can buy ads to show to people who are specifically looking for what it is that you offer. So if they're searching for what it is you do, they've got, coaching to grow my business. That's something people are looking for. You can get right in front of those people with AdWords and with YouTube ads based on what they're searching. On Facebook, you can find an audience of where they might be and put up a billboard. And then the closest thing is, this falls into the horse for sale. And the idea of being proximate to where somebody's about to make this decision. Like if you have a horse for sale in a place where somebody's looking for a horse, all you need is a sign that says horse for sale. And that's the same thing I thought about Snapple. when Snapple launched their mango flavor, they contracted with the Mango Growers Association to put stickers on 10 million mangoes that said now available in Snapple. So you're going right to the people who already love mangoes with a message to market match that the person mm-hmm. who loves mangoes is likely to buy Snapple. Mm-hmm. And that's a, you know, that kind of thinking, Vistaprint started out, what launched them was they got their literature inside every box of Microsoft Publisher that was sold.
Yeah.
So people buy Microsoft Publisher, they're going to be desktop publishing and making brochures and business cards and stuff, and they're going to want to get them printed. So,
well, it's like Paul Abel, yes, you know, has exactly. these great, you know, he's got these great collaborations with payroll companies who automatically send out,
yes.
you know, payroll statements to their,
yes.
you know, to 50 million people. It's now 50 yes. million number of payroll companies. And he just puts compliance information, gives them the latest compliance information related to, you know, work rules regarding their local city, their local county, their state, the federal, and any change. And it satisfies the requirement for the employers that they've informed their employees. And he's even got a thing now that automatically tracks employees. So if they move, which a lot, you know, they're now remote learning and they've gone to another state, automatically the records are updated and the information now goes to them pertinent to where they are now. And, you know, but he's using someone else's capability to enhance his.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and that's we do what that. I got.
And we do that. And and in the species of people who do that, there are people who are at the top and people who are at the bottom.
That's right. They have the capability,
yeah,
not the ability.
Everybody's learning. It's just everybody's learning something. The only question is it stuff that individually moves you ahead?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking like you. I said, what would Dan Sullivan do? As I think through that. And I think, no, because you've got a very unique model of this is the idea. This is the example. What's the thought process that I have to evaluate this by? And what's the example? So how would I apply this? And I thought like I could present that idea of the proximity things like the horse for sale. You present those ideas and the thinking process would be, where are proximity things that, you know, that are available? What to help people navigate
I would
other
say
people's
the one
reach
area
out.
That one area where I think I've really put in on something that was meaningful to everybody is why are you confident during this period and other people aren't?
Mm.
So that was everybody's experiencing. You know, since the COVID started, I said, so why are you thinking positively and other people aren't thinking positively? And then people analyze it and they, you know, they use their experiences. And the other thing is, why is this Zoom thing such a breakthrough? So here's the thing that we're having our best year ever right now.
Yeah.
Historically, this is the best sales year ever. We had our best June, July. Usually our lowest months are June and July in the sales year. And we just had two really super June, July.
That's awesome.
But the other thing is that we have about a third of our clients who said, well, I'm not renewing until it's in person again.
Right.
So last year, somewhere, you know, between March and the end of the year, they said to themselves, well, we'll just hold off and when you come back. So what's happening now is starting in September with Chicago and then all through the rest of the year, we're just getting this massive movement back of people who were technically what we called out clients.
And right.
They didn't renew, and now they're coming. So this would be our best, we call it out back in OBI.
Yeah.
This would be our best OBI year ever. So our best sales year and our best OBI year. And I said, I think, you know, part of it is that we just went right at the central problem of their confidence going through this and then their use of this new technological breakthrough. So,
yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's going to be, yeah, hopefully the old Delta maneuver holds out, or the Delta variant does, right? We're at Florida just set a record yesterday for all of COVID, the highest number of new cases since the beginning of it. So Florida's like past its pinnacle and still.
Yeah, but you know what they've discovered? That the only issue is hospitalization. Mm-hmm. And the numbers for the Delta for hospitalization is really, really low.
Well, and that's good.
Part of the reason is that communities have really, really increased enormously their capability to handle people and diagnose them and everything else without hospitalization. Okay. And so that the head of the CDC, we're past time, so this won't be part of the program, but the CDC, this woman, Dr. Walensky. And, mm-hmm. and so Brett Baier, who is probably the best evening TV guy on all of television. He's on Fox and he has the 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock with Brett Baier. And he's pretty, you know, he's pretty kind of factual. He just lets people get out what they have to say. So he said, Dr. Walensky, he says, I just want to point out some numbers. The first number is that you have here is that the 164 million Americans have been vaccinated now. 164 million, is that correct? And she says, yes, that's correct number. And he says, now, in this Delta thing, and I don't know what he was looking at specifically, but he says, here are the numbers for the number of reported cases, and here's the number of people hospitalized. And it's like, against all the population in the United States, it's like 0.0001, 0.002. He says, this statistically, this doesn't even show up as a problem. And she says, and this is where authorities lose their credibility. She says, well, the numbers don't mean what they seem to mean.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
And Brett Baier, you could just see his eyes. His eyes just kind of went strange for a second. He says, what do you mean the numbers don't mean what they seem to be? He says, you agreed with the numbers. Why don't they mean what they mean? And she says, well, these are passive reports. And I said, passive reports? Yeah. She says, what you have to have is active reports where... and he says, well, which method have they used throughout the COVID period? And she said, well, it was passive, but now we're changing the rules and what counts.
Oh, my goodness.
And people are at home and they're kind of saying, is this a rerun of roller derby we can watch?
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. But it just shows you. Yeah, yeah. In other words, we've changed the rules. We've changed the rules. So
that's crazy.
Yeah, it's actually 5 minutes to 12. We've changed that when the big hand is 11, it actually means it's at the top of the hour.
There we go. Perfect. I love it.
Anyway, great joy.
All right, Dan. Yes, always fun.
A joy. But give some thought to that, so, getting somebody in to talk about that at the summit. That would be great.
I will. Yeah, I think he would be great. I'm going to try.
It'll be live. Live.
Yeah.
We can have a big screen if we want, but it'll be live from, we can have him live on Zoom with a big screen, and because it'll be live in Phoenix.
Yeah. When are we doing that?
End of February.
Okay. Perfect.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay. Bye.
I'll talk to you soon. Bye.